Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Donald Trump has been asking Congress for one big, beautiful bill. Last month, on a razor-thin vote, the House gave him his wish and sent that bill to the Senate. It contains $4.9 trillion in tax breaks, mostly for the rich, and new work requirements for Medicaid. It also makes Trump's 2017 tax cuts permanent. Critics say, as written, the bill will add trillions to the national debt, and that is why it became a flashpoint in the falling out between Trump and Elon Musk. Musk called it a disgusting abomination and urged lawmakers to reject it. The Senate is divided, with some lawmakers there expressing strong opposition, while others are pushing for its passage. Passage would have ramifications for every state, including our own, where it would impact everything from hurricane recovery to health coverage. Meanwhile, a new travel ban has gone into effect, along with the Trump administration moving forward with revoking temporary legal status of more than 500,000 immigrants. With all that and the protests springing up around the country over Trump-mandated ICE activity, it is time to take Capitol Hill's temperature. And to help us do that, we welcome back two reporters who cover the Hill every day. Danielle Battaglia is congressional correspondent for the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer, and Reuben Jones is the Washington correspondent covering North Carolina and national politics for Spectrum News One. Welcome back, everybody. Nice to see you.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. Thank you for doing it. Reuben, I'm going to start with you. Donald Trump has been talking about Congress passing his big, beautiful bill since the campaign, one big bill that would provide major tax cuts and economic reforms in his mind. Is that what the House passed?
In a way, yes. The vast majority of House Republicans voted for this, I'm going to call it Republican tax bill, because the big focus on a number of changes in the tax law, a number of changes in when it comes to Medicaid. There's no Democratic support for this in Congress. Now the bill sits before the Senate, where it is going to undergo significant changes. I'm sure we'll get into quite a few of them. But the big concern here from not only Republicans, but also some Republicans, is that the Congressional Budget Office, which is a nonpartisan organization that looks at the financials of this, is that this bill would spike the deficit by almost $2.5 trillion over the decade, and leave nearly 11 people without health insurance. Now, Republicans will disagree on some points of that, but that's from the Congressional Budget Office.
And it would increasing the deficit without, or the debt without any major changes, does impact us all, because it impacts our credit standing. And already around the world, certain agencies have been lowering the United States credit rating. Danielle, what major tax cuts, what major economic reforms does this bill, as it sits right now, contain?
I mean, there are a lot of things that I'm looking at with it, from Medicaid cuts to SNAP cuts to clean energy tax credit cuts to even a tobacco drawback on tariffs. And so there are so many different elements within this bill that will affect North Carolinians and their livelihoods.
This bill proposes, Reuben, to make Donald Trump's 2017 tax cuts, which were scheduled to sunset, the bill would make them permanent, whatever that means, because I guess the next president could come in and say, let's change this, or propose to change it. Who benefits from those 2017 cuts?
Well, certainly the tax cuts apply to more wealthy Americans, and that's sort of how the legislation is worded, is a nearly $4 trillion in tax cuts in it. And, you know, there's also no taxes on tips, which would benefit others. But the big concern and the argument from Democrats is that this will benefit the wealthy and not benefit other Americans.
Yeah, the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, I'd never heard of them before tomorrow, but before yesterday rather, but they are a nonpartisan research and policy institute that looks at the impact of federal policies. They say that those cuts were, in fact, skewed to favor the rich. Households in the top 1% and the top 5% received cuts that were more than triple the total value of the cuts received for people with incomes in the bottom 60%. They say those cuts also failed to deliver the $4,000 boost in household income promised by the first Trump administration and added significantly to our already burgeoning debt. So, Danielle, do Republicans in the House, or for that matter in the Senate, take issue with any of that? I know that there are a few, but not many.
I mean, the Republicans in the House, they largely passed this. Actually, I think they passed it completely. There was one person, I believe, who was not supportive, and then two who did not vote on it, or who voted present on it. Otherwise, it went through with all support from Republicans.
Is this, Mike, go ahead.
I say that the big concern I think we hear from Republicans more is the impact this would have on the deficit. That's why Kentucky Republican Congressman Thomas Massie was against it. And now what we also hear concern about are a few sort of specific nuggets within the legislation, but also concerns about what this will mean for Medicaid. We've heard some concerns from that. A number of Republican senators have expressed concern about how this bill currently is at, including Rand Paul of Kentucky, Josh Hawley, two very conservative senators.
Well, I was going to ask something else, but I'll move on. Included in this bill are two tax cuts that you've already mentioned. I think it was you, Ruben, that said that talked about the no tax on tips. The other one is it would allow deductions on auto loan interest for American-made cars. Does that mean you will not be able to deduct the interest on your loan if you buy a Volvo?
Yeah, I'm not sure on that one. I know that there are significant changes for drawing back the electric vehicle credits, tax credits, and a lot of the clean energy initiatives that we saw under the Biden administration would go away under this, which has concern in places like North Carolina, which has really become an EV hub over the past few years.
Is that also what's driving some of the feud between Donald Trump and Elon Musk? Because Elon is the head of Tesla.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to weigh into that because that feud, I mean, I think I saw a tweet from Elon this morning that said maybe I was a little bit too hard on Donald Trump. So, I mean, this feud, how much is it a feud? I don't know. How much of this is politics, how much of this is play, and how much of this is about Tesla, his number one bread and butter company, is going to be hurt by this bill. That plays into this as well, I'm sure.
Tax on tips. He's been promising this since the campaign. And of course, people who make a lot of their money as waiters and waitresses and bartenders, etc., they don't make a lot of money in the first place. And tax on tips, having no tax on tips, would be beneficial to them. Has anybody, however, calculated the impact on the federal budget from tax on tips? I guess a lot of that goes unreported anyway, but would it have any significant impact on our revenues?
Yeah, I haven't seen projections on that. Maybe Danielle has. If I'm not mistaken, taxes on tips, though, was also supported by Vice President Kamala Harris during the election as well. So there is some bipartisan support when it comes to that specific tax.
So the tax provisions in this bill have some in the Senate, we just talked about them, at odds with Trump. Aside from Elon Musk, Danielle, who is unelected and now out of favor, at least for the moment, and his characterization of this bill as being a disgusting abomination because of those tax provisions and because of what experts have said that will be the impact on the debt. Aside from Rand Paul and Chuck Grassley has another problem with this bill. We'll talk about it in a moment. But Rand Paul and Hawley, who else has expressed any reservations about this in the Senate at all?
Well, obviously, I'm paying attention to what Senator Tillis and Senator Butt are looking at because there are senators. And so I've been following them pretty closely. And Senator Tillis has reservations actually on the no tax on tips. He also has reservations about the clean energy tax credit cuts. And I've seen Bud has not spoken out on this bill directly, but he has been in meetings with top senators about Medicaid cuts and what that would do to North Carolina. They both also have concerns about this tobacco drawback cut that could be coming.
We spoke a couple of weeks ago to the president of Davidson College because this bill not only cuts certain kinds of taxes, it proposes some tax increases. And you reported, Danielle, at one point that the House Republicans proposed increasing from 1.4 to 7% taxes on the Duke University and Davidson College endowments. That's what we talked in part to the Davidson College president about. Did that make it into the final version of the House bill as it passed?
It's in that final version. And so what we're looking at is the two schools, they're both private schools, and they are essentially punishing them for being what Republicans are calling woke elitist schools, for having a higher endowment than other private schools in North Carolina. And so Duke and Davidson are both looking at having a tax raise from 1.4% to 7%. I think there is a lot of lobbying going on behind the scenes to see if that can either go away or if it could somehow be turned around to benefit the schools. But that that is something that is still actively being looked at.
Some see this as part and parcel of an attack on higher education and education in general in this country. Is that how members of the Senate see it? Ruben, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I was just going to say, just real quick, back to the schools, because this has been really interesting to follow. I did some reporting on this, like Danielle, about a month ago, and talked to the Davidson president, who's, by the way, been up here lobbying lawmakers. Duke has hired a lobbying firm that is staffed by former North Carolina Republican Senator Richard Burr to try and focus on this endowment issue, an issue that would really have a significant impact on private schools around the country that have significant endowments. The argument for the private schools is that these endowments are used to help financial aid for low-income students. Now, others would argue it is sort of these schools have too much money and there's a lot of waste being used on the funds. But the argument from the private schools is this would have a significant impact. We have seen legislation, Mike, introduced quite a bit from Republicans, including just recently, that was focused on this question of endowments. It was something under the first Trump administration, endowment taxes were increased as well. So this is sort of taking it to the next level. And it's part of, as you say, Mike, this targeting, if you will, of higher ed by the Trump administration. Obviously, we've seen it most notably play out at schools like Harvard and Columbia, but Duke is also front and center on this as well, and a number of other schools around the country.
And the two schools that we're talking specifically about right now, Duke and Davidson, are both in North Carolina. And I'm curious, Danielle, what Ted Budd, our junior senator, and what Tom Tillis, our senior senator, have had to say specifically about this proposal in this bill.
Yeah, I actually don't remember what they told me on this. It's been a while since I wrote about it.
I wish I could tell you, but I read it yesterday. I don't remember it either. Do you, Ruben?
I'm so sorry.
Okay. I'll plead the fifth on that. I didn't talk to them on that.
This is part and parcel of the news cycle as we now live through it, which is second by second, things change, and you just can't remember it. When we come back from the break, we're going to talk about some other portions of this big, beautiful bill and what it may or may not do, including what its impact may be on clean energy in North Carolina and agriculture, because you mentioned, Danielle, the tobacco provision in this. I didn't know that tobacco was still big in this state, but evidently it is really big in this state, and this would have to do with taxing tobacco products that go out of the country, come back into the country. It sounds very much like the automobile industry. Daniel Battaglia is with us from the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer, and Ruben Jones, a reporter covering Washington and national politics for Spectrum News One. And we will continue our conversation in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the big, beautiful bill that passed the House, now sits in the Senate. That's the tax and spend bill that Donald Trump has been asking for since the presidential campaign. And we're talking about it with two people who cover Capitol Hill every single day, Daniel Battagli, who does it for The Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer, and Reuben Jones, who does the same thing for Spectrum News One. As you know, North Carolina was late to expand Medicaid and only did so when the state was guaranteed that the federal government would pick up a certain portion, actually the majority of the cost of the expansion of Medicaid. The result is that hundreds of thousands of people now find themselves eligible for health care benefits that they didn't have access to before. But Reuben, this big, beautiful bill proposes some restrictions on Medicaid, which could lead to millions of people around the country losing their health care. And I'm told that amounts to about 260,000 people, which is about half of the people who found themselves added to the Medicaid rolls as a result of the expansion. What does this bill propose?
Yeah, I mean, it is basically, Democrats will say this is people being cut from Medicaid. Republicans will argue that this is changes to work restrictions. But at the end of the day, as we mentioned earlier, the Congressional Budget Office says millions of people would lose their health insurance under this bill. This is a major concern of the governor, of Democrats in North Carolina and healthcare advocates who are worried about this being a significant rollback to Medicaid expansion in North Carolina. People who had just gotten insurance would now potentially lose it. And so there's a lot of worries about what this bill could mean for people around the state.
And Daniel, the bill does propose work requirements for Medicaid. Are these requirements, how would people describe them? Are they draconian? Are they reasonable? Or are they simply perhaps impractical given a person's situation that finds themselves in need of these benefits?
I think it depends on the person. So the work requirements require 80 hours per month to work, and that can be either working, volunteering, or being in school. But you have to remember people who are on Medicaid, some of them are disabled, some of them are elderly, some of them just can't work. And so I think, you know, there's the argument to be made that, you know, these could be draconian to them, but other people, you know,
Are there carve-outs for those people, people who are disabled, people who are elderly and can't work or shouldn't work because they're in their 80s? I mean,
that is a good question. I have not seen that carve-out, but I want to double-check that.
Okay. The bill also impacts people on SNAP. That is the old food stamp program, essentially. And last month, Governor Josh Stein urged members of the House to reject that portion of the bill because it would result in 1.4 million SNAP recipients, including children, the elderly, the disabled, and low-income workers, losing SNAP benefits. Reuben, what was the House's response? Obviously, it's still in the bill, so they just ignored it?
Yeah, from my knowledge, there weren't many changes. The SNAP and what is known as food assistance for millions of Americans around the country remains. Those cuts remain in the legislation. So again, similar to what we saw with the Medicaid changes, this is another big concern from Democrats. Danielle can correct me, but I have not seen as much concern expressed from Republicans on this point, perhaps, as I've seen about the question of Medicaid.
I think that's true. And I'm curious about it because this would actually make the state have to pay around $600 million, because essentially what it does is give 5% of the cost of the program to the state, which has never been done before. And so people like Governor Josh Stein is raising the alarm that that's essentially the entire North Carolina public safety fund and or department's fund. And so like when you look at that and compare it, you're going to have to make major cuts to North Carolina's budget somewhere to sustain this program. And he's got concerns about, do I let people go hungry or do I continue to fund public safety, which I should say that's not what's being cut to fund food.
And it's a lot of people because you report, Danielle, that 13% of the state's residents get SNAP benefits. That's an enormous number. And 66% of that 13% are children. Essentially, the federal government wants to shift most of the burden to the states for this program. And this is not the only program that they're aiming to do that on. And it may not be in this bill, but they have desires to shift a lot of things, lots of federal responsibilities to the states. Can we afford this? Has the legislature budgeted for this? Can they, if this passes the Senate and becomes law, can they take up the slack?
It doesn't sound like it if you listen to the governor. I don't think Ruben and I are paying attention to the state's budget process as closely as we are to the federal. However, I haven't heard that those discussions are ongoing on the state level at this point. I think when they're looking at their budgets, there's probably conversations going on in the background of like, what if we have to pick this up? But at the same time, they're looking at what they know will be in their budget.
And if you're trying to cut the budget and the deficit, which this bill does not do, but if you're trying to do that, this could be a legitimate place to examine to see maybe you could cut here or trim there. But there are often, as with many of these cuts that the Trump administration has been indulging in through DOGE and other means, there are unintended and often unconsidered consequences. This isn't just about the recipients of SNAP who will lose benefits should this pass. It is retailers, it is businesses, because SNAP brings about $2.8 billion into the state, and much of that money goes to grocers and the people who supply grocers with that food. You would think that the larger chamber, the House, would be more connected to those realities, but are they, or is the Senate, Ruben, likely to be more sensitive to something like this, the unintended consequences?
Perhaps. I will say we have seen a number of Republicans, House Republicans, who have come out with some concerns as more and more has come out about this bill. The House did not have a lot of time to go into the weeds of this bill, and we're starting to see that play out, whether it was I think it was Marjorie Taylor Greene who expressed concern about what this would mean in terms of this bill would make it a lot harder for states to regulate artificial intelligence, AI. We saw the Attorney General, Jeff Jackson, speak out about this. I've got a story about that coming out later this week. The 13 House Republicans also sent a letter recently expressing concerns on what this bill would mean for clean energy cuts. So what we're seeing is House Republicans who voted for this bill starting to find parts in it they do not like. And now we'll see if the Senate makes those changes. Remember, any changes that the Senate makes, the House is going to have to still vote for. So we still have a long way to go on this bill actually becoming law, and it could go through some major reforms.
And we should point out that the disagreements between House versions and Senate versions of bill is not unusual. This is how it goes through Congress. It becomes law or not. North Carolina Senator Ted Budd has pledged his and other Republican senators' support for this bill, but he says improvements to the House version can be made. And Danielle, you report that he was among the senators who met with Senate Majority Leader John Thune about Medicaid cuts and what they would mean for rural communities. Is that to say that he and others recognize the importance of Medicaid, not just to the recipients themselves, but to rural medical facilities who have benefited from this? Many of them were going out of business prior to the expansion of Medicaid because they weren't being paid for services, and now they are. Is there a concern about that?
My understanding was that was the root cause of his concerns. Now, I have not heard him speak directly about it still, but I think there is that concern. He is from Davie County. It's a rural area. He's surrounded by rural areas. And there is that overarching concern that if we have these cuts, the rural hospitals can, or rural medical centers can be harmed by it.
And remember, the proposed changes to Medicaid would significantly impact red Republican states that are perhaps high poverty and that have adopted Medicaid expansion, which is why you're seeing some Republican senators express concern about what this would mean for Medicaid recipients.
Well, a lot of what Donald Trump wants to do in this bill and others seems to be something that will hurt ordinary Americans, not the rich, but people who are getting by, scraping by paycheck to paycheck more than anybody else. Are they playing into the hands of Democrats? This is, these people are have been, until this last election cycle, traditional Democratic supporters. And if you're cutting my Medicaid, if you're cutting my SNAP benefits, can't the Democrats, won't the Democrats use that in the midterms and beyond as leverage?
I think Medicaid will no doubt, if this bill becomes law, no doubt become a prime focus of Democrats in the midterm elections. I was just speaking with a Democratic strategist about this recently. So I would expect Medicaid to come up. I would expect Democrats would also focus on tariffs, inflation, if inflation were to increase, although we saw today didn't go up as much as some expected, and a number of other things. But yes, Medicaid, no doubt, I think will be a big focus next year.
And one piece of this bill, Danielle, that Senator Tillis, Tom Tillis, has been most vocal about are the cuts to the clean energy tax credits. The bill repeals clean energy incentives, and some say that that will ultimately increase household energy costs by hundreds of dollars a year. What specifically does this bill propose?
Yeah, so this takes out the Inflation Reduction Act's tax credits for things like giving manufacturing businesses for like solar, wind, things like that. It takes out the credits that they were supposed to receive. And not only what was anticipated was to get rid of those credits going forward, but this is actually going to take away promised tax cuts that businesses built their businesses on. And so it was greater than anticipated. And North Carolina is ninth in the nation for clean energy. And so some of these businesses were building in North Carolina on the promises of getting these tax credits and now looking at losing them. So Senator Tillis has some great concerns about what this does to their bottom line and making sure they have a cushion to be able to continue and not have harm coming to their companies.
There was an article in your paper, The Observer, this morning about the potential of these cuts crushing the clean energy business sector in North Carolina. Why would you want to do that? Clean energy clearly is the future. Clean energy is generating jobs. It's lowering energy costs. It's making the environment cleaner. Is this strictly because the president and others are in the pocket of the oil industry?
That is definitely what's been opined about it, yes.
Well, and clean energy was, I mean, obviously a big focus of the Biden administration. And so President Trump, much of what President Biden pursued, President Trump
Ruben, I'm sorry, you broke up for a second. You went away for a second.
So sorry about that.
Go back and repeat that.
So clean energy was a big focus of the Biden administration, obviously, and much of what Biden has done, Trump has tried to reverse. And Trump has pretty consistently been very against electric vehicles, or at least against federal assistance in terms of tax credits for EVs. So, you know, I think some of this was expected during versus anything that was played out in the Inflation Reduction Act, played out in the bipartisan infrastructure law as well on clean energy.
The Washington Examiner, Ruben, reports that Tillis and Budd are being pressured by the state's agriculture sector. This is something that Danielle brought up a moment ago over provisions in this bill. One element that they want removed from this bill is the so-called duty drawback. I'd never heard of this before yesterday, but it impacts tobacco. How so?
So this duty drawback, always have to like read this as I say it because it gets confusing, but essentially there are tariffs, and what's happening with these tariffs is the tobacco industry, when they export a product and then import it back, if they either export it back or destroy it, they aren't taxed on it again, is essentially what's happening. So they're not getting double taxed on it, and they want to do away with that that tax. And so essentially what is being argued is that this will have major repercussions on the tobacco industry because they could get double taxed on their product.
And evidently, if that provision is withdrawn, it would cost that industry tens of millions of dollars in taxes every single year. How big is the tobacco industry in North Carolina today, right now, after all these years?
I don't have a good number to give you on that, but it is a sizable portion still. The people who are absolutely against this provision says it will completely decimate the industry in North Carolina.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, the tobacco is really big in eastern North Carolina. I mean, you go out there and there's a lot of tobacco farms. It's why we saw Democrat Congressman Don Davis, who represents that area, as well as Republicans who were against the menthol ban that President Biden was considering signing, did not eventually end up signing it. But the menthol ban, the concern was that it would have a significant impact on the tobacco industry in North Carolina.
Back in 2023, the North Carolina Republican Party censured Tom Tillis for blatant violations, their words, of their party's platform. He escaped a repeat of that in recent years, but he has been outspoken on a couple of issues that are near and dear to the MAGA crowd, and he will be up for re-election in 2 years, next year. How much of an influence, Danielle, is the reality likely to be on his level of support or opposition for this bill?
I think everything Tillis does right now is under a microscope, especially with the MAGA movement. So, you know, every breath he takes is being watched. And if he doesn't fall in line with President Trump, I think he's going to face a lot of backlash from the far right Republicans in North Carolina. And he's come up against Trump occasionally since he's retaken office. We haven't seen a lot of pushback from Trump when he's done it yet, but I think if he crosses him at the wrong time, you know, people keep saying it takes one tweet from President Trump to ruin his reelection.
Ruben, we spoke about Medicaid cuts proposed in this bill, but Tom Tillis is proposing Medicare changes. That's a different animal. He said he wants to find efficiencies in Medicare and support specific legislation to address waste in the Medicare Advantage program. What do you know about that?
I'll be honest, that's not something I've been covering. Danielle, is that something you've been covering?
So I just heard about it this morning, but it sounds like he is trying to stop overpayments to insurance companies is what he's proposing. He is one that it seems like he doesn't want to hurt the public, but he also wants to root out wasteful spending is what he's saying.
Okay, we have to take a break. We'll come back and talk more about what's in this bill and other things happening on Capitol Hill in a moment at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. We're talking about the big, beautiful bill, which passed the House, goes now to the Senate. It's sitting in the Senate. It's being debated by senators, and they'll decide whether or not Donald Trump gets his wish. Danielle Battaglia covers this for the News and Observer and the Charlotte Observer, and Reuben Jones does so for Spectrum News One. We'll talk about that bill and other things going on Capitol Hill. Senator Tillis, has also introduced legislation to replenish the disaster relief fund ahead of this year's hurricane season, which just started 11 days ago. This comes right after the Trump administration denied our state's request for Hurricane Helene relief at the level previously approved by the Biden administration. Biden proposed cost sharing with the state of 100%, matching our state essentially dollar for dollar. How much money is Tillis, Ruben, asking for? Ruben, unmute yourself.
Sorry about that. I believe he is seeking about $1.5 billion. I think Danielle's covered that specific closely, but I think it was about $1.5 billion for disaster relief.
Danielle?
I thought it was closer to $25 billion, but I could be wrong.
That might be. I haven't covered that. Yeah.
So is this, once again, this is a reversal of a policy put in place by the Biden administration that Trump wants to reverse or reduce or change or take away or whatever, because he's doing this throughout various aspects of what happened. Is this simply politics? Is this normal, or is this part and parcel of Donald Trump's intense dislike of Joe Biden?
Well, I mean, if we want to talk FEMA real quick, so I mean, FEMA is one of the agencies that is undergoing perhaps some of the biggest changes in the Trump administration. So real quickly, FEMA was a big sore spot for the president when he was running for office, when Helene hit Western North Carolina. The president then took office and came to Western North Carolina and basically said FEMA should be eliminated.
Now, but a lot of the things that he was saying on the campaign trail about FEMA, specifically with regard to North Carolina, were simply untrue.
Correct. And there was a lot of misinformation evolved around that was amped up and ramped up by the president. And we could point to specific examples for sure. Nonetheless, he has continued to ramp up concern about FEMA, and now he's basically proposed eliminating it. So how that has played out so far is that he has reduced the amount, and he said this just yesterday, he has reduced the amount of federal match money that some states are receiving for natural disasters. You mentioned North Carolina. North Carolina was receiving 100% federal match for Helene to cover debris removal costs, which were very expensive. That lowered to 90% because FEMA decided not to continue the 100% number. Now, that's customary because it typically lowers, but because of how extreme Helene was, the hope was that number would stay at 100%. Nonetheless, that 10% difference, the state says, will cost the state hundreds of million dollars to take care of debris removal. So it's part of a bigger change that FEMA is going through.
So Trump's been highly critical of FEMA based on delusions. Nothing real. What he's talking about is simply not true, but it's in his head. And he's cutting FEMA, not just here, but around the country. He wants to diminish FEMA's potential, which will cause them to actually, I guess, realize what his worst fears about FEMA are. This is a self-fulfilling prophecy, isn't it?
There is some agreement, I will say, among Democrats and Republicans that FEMA can go through changes. That means getting rid of some of the bureaucracy, speeding up the process of some of the assistance that FEMA offers, and a few other changes. But there is also agreement among both sides that there has to be some sort of federal body in place that distributes federal assistance. States like North Carolina, states around the country, with perhaps the exception of Florida and Texas, that even need a little bit of federal assistance. They need federal help to take care of an emergency afterwards. They just aren't equipped to have the resources and do that. So I think there is agreement that FEMA, whether it's called FEMA, whether it's called something else, something has to be in place. And that's why this is of major concern from some as he talks about completely rethinking what FEMA looks like.
And Danielle, you were right. Senator Tillis has introduced legislation to replenish the disaster relief fund to the tune of $25 billion. He introduced that legislation a little while ago. One final thing on this big, beautiful bill. It proposes to weaken federal courts' ability to hold government officials accountable, making it harder to enforce contempt of court citations. Chuck Grassley from Iowa has said this is a bugaboo for him. Since Trump is constantly testing the court and often ignoring them or treating them in a way that would earn ordinary mortals a contempt citation, is this opening the door to ending any supervision by the judicial branch of the executive branch? Danielle.
I like that we stared at each other. I think the quick answer would be probably yes. He is one that multiple times got contempt charges by judges throughout various hearings that he faced ahead of being president. But I think you can also look at, as he went through legal challenges before his presidency, once he was reelected, those all vanished anyways.
But if this were to go through, would this not upend the Constitution and end the rule of law?
I feel like you ask me this every time I'm on the show, and I hate to...
I ask everybody on the show exactly what it would do.
I know. I was going to say yes, but it sounds so dark to say it.
Chuck Grassley is opposed to this, not just because he may be opposed to it fundamentally, but he says Senate rules will prevent this provision of this bill from going through because the Senate evidently has a rule that says only things that are germane to the bill at hand, in this case a budget bill, can be considered as part of that bill, and this is not something that touches on the budget. Is that fundamentally his argument against this? And how many people in the Senate, how many senators agree with him, have the same reservations as he does?
Well, this came out first thing this morning, so I don't think we've heard a lot from other senators on it yet. And I'd be really curious who would join him in that. But, you know, it's still early in the morning, so we'll see. We'll see how that goes.
So whatever happens to this bill in the Senate, Ruben, this big, beautiful bill, it will have to go back to the House for reconciliation. That's how this works. Elon Musk and the Democrats have suggested throwing the whole thing in the trash heap and starting over. Is that even remotely likely in a Congress controlled by the Republican Party?
No.
End of quote. Okay, let's move on to some other things that are going on that impact Capitol Hill or not. L.A. County and the city of Los Angeles are the site of the mostly peaceful demonstrations. There have been violence. There has been damage to property in those demonstrations that are taking place in Los Angeles against ICE arrests occurring there. Local law enforcement appeared to have the situation under control, and then Trump federalized the California National Guard without consulting Governor Newsom, and later called in hundreds of Marines, and others are standing by to come in. That has inflamed tensions, but so far, things have been in relatively calm. The situation, however, is unprecedented because of his calling in and federalizing the National Guard and calling in federal combat troops to be on the streets of an American city. What have members of Congress had to say about this? And is it split along party lines, Danielle?
I think we've seen some Senate Republicans, and I can't remember who it was, come out and say that this should not be happening. You're essentially turning, you know, military against the public, which isn't done.
I believe it's against the law. Is it not against the law? Does it not violate the posse comitatus provision?
It does. And it's you know, they are trained to protect and defend us, where law enforcement is trained to, you know, uphold laws on the streets. I'm not saying this well, but you're taking a different group of people who are trained to do something different to now defend against your own citizens. And that's a very different beast that we're looking at right now.
There are those who fear that Trump wants this confrontation between citizens and law enforcement, protesters and law enforcement, as an excuse to use federal troops in more places. He's promised to deploy them, and that may already be underway. I don't know. He's made promises yesterday that anybody interfering with his big, beautiful parade on his birthday through the streets of Washington will face very strong opposition from, we can assume, law enforcement. There's been very little violence in all of this, and Americans have a constitutional right to peaceably assemble and express their grievances with the government. Some say that what Trump is doing is right out of an authoritarian playbook. Is this being discussed outside of Democratic circles on Capitol Hill, Ruben?
Not very much publicly, perhaps behind the scenes, but a lot of it, as you say, Mike, has fallen along party lines in terms of concerns about these protests and in terms of the response to these protests.
These are people sitting on Capitol Hill who endured the attack on the Capitol on January the 6th. What's happening in Los Angeles bears no resemblance to that whatsoever, but they're okay with that?
Well, and I think that that is partly what we heard from, I believe was Nancy Pelosi, who said, why did we struggle to get National Guard troops on January 6th, but now we can so easily get them for what's happening in L.A.?
Donald Trump's travel ban took effect also this week after midnight on Monday. It bars nationals from 12 countries from entering the United States and partially restricts access to another seven. He did this in his first term and promised to resurrect it as part of his campaign, and now he's done it. And in 2017, his Muslim ban prompted immediate outcry, and it prompted legal challenges as well. This time, the ban mostly affects people from Africa and the Middle East, and reaction has been muted. Why?
Yeah, I mean, it's been pretty muted from Republicans. I will say there was one Republican, Mike Lawler in New York, who had specific concerns about the Haiti ban and said that this was not fair to the Haitian people. But yeah, I mean, and look, a lot of this is not a surprise given the travel ban we saw put in place in the first Trump administration. And the courts kind of gave him the go ahead in terms of doing this in the second Trump admin. Now, there will be challenges for sure. There's legislation introduced in Congress to try and appeal this travel ban and get rid of it. But yes, as you say, Mike, the opposition has been quite muted from Republicans. Of course, Democrats have been very opposed to it.
And of course, opposition publicly to this has been muted in comparison to the first administration, which is one of the first things that he did after Inauguration Day years ago. People showed up at airports and protested all across the country. Right. That's not happening. Is that because he has successfully flooded the zone with so many other things simultaneously that we just can't keep up?
Well, 2 points. One, this travel ban gave a little bit more of a notice than perhaps the last one, so you didn't have those scenes playing out at airports like we saw in the first Trump administration. There's also some restrictions put in place in the travel ban that would exempt a number of people from this. But yes, there is a flood of, and we saw this in the start of the administration, we're seeing it now, we'll continue to see it, a flood of actions by this White House and the administration that make it hard for people who are concerned to focus their concerns and their opposition. Where do they pinpoint it? Where do they go with it in order to have the most impact?
The Supreme Court, on a 5-3 vote, also allowed the Trump administration to revoke temporary legal status for more than 500,000 immigrants. They were made legal during the Biden presidency, and now they face deportation. Who are these people? Why were they given legal status under Biden? Why does Trump want to revoke it? And why did the Supreme Court side with him?
Yeah, this was in terms of the, do you want to take this, Daniel? I didn't want to, I covered this and I'm just refreshing my mind because as we say, there's been an inundation. This right. is, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mike, this is the legal protections for Venezuelans. And this had been a significant question in terms of what would be the legal protection for them. Venezuela has obviously been the heart of this. But yeah, this was all about Venezuelans.
You've been following two stories, Ruben, that have to do with Robert Kennedy Jr. Yesterday, he removed all of the current members of the CDC Vaccine Advisory Committee. All of them were experts in the field, and he's replaced them. They have historically guided vaccine recommendations put out by the government. Robert Kennedy, is a vaccine skeptic, and he says that body was, quote, plagued with conflicts of interest. In what way?
That's been his argument all along, that there is a pro-vaccine, pro-drug corporation bias within the Department of Health and Human Services, including within this vaccine committee. The reality is that this vaccine committee, members who are part of it, including there's a UNC Chapel Hill doctor who's part of this, go through rigorous conflict of interest vetting before they can serve on this committee. And so, that is just the clear fact about it. So RFK has said that he wants to strip them of this and bring in new voices and restore trust in this agency and restore some of the bias that is there. We'll see if that comes together. But this is a dramatic change for this committee.
And it seems to fly in the face of his congressional testimony that he gave during his appointment hearings. Some say he lied to Congress. He wouldn't be the only person who has shifted gears since their confirmation hearings and been accused of lying to Congress. Are members of Congress upset about this? Are they talking about retaliation or some kind of a backlash to this kind of thing?
Well, obviously, Democrats are concerned. Republicans, there have been a few that have expressed some questions as to why this has happened. The most notable senator is Bill Cassidy on this, a doctor who was on the fence with RFK. He has sort of been on the fence about this as well. We'll wait to watch on him.
And I know you have to run to the House side of the building. You're on the Senate side, so let me let you go, Ruben, because we're out of time anyway. Ruben Jones is with us from Spectrum News One and Daniel Battaglia reporting on Capitol Hill for Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks
Thank
so
you.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.